It has been suggested by one of our members, John Ensminger, that we take a moment this morning to gather our thoughts. This is the anniversary of 9/11, the anniversary of the two terrorist planes into the two towers in New York City, of course, another plane into the Pentagon. But we must remember as well so many more recent tragedies of terrorists, such as in Beslan, where the children killed there, the adults there are our children too. What's happened in Sudan for too long, in Indonesia. And all these kinds of activities that hatred drives terrorists to do. So if we just take a few moments and gather your thoughts in your own way about these matters. Thank you. We are indeed a very fortunate country, and indeed, I believe, a very fortunate province. What we are engaged in, the Citizens' Assembly on Electoral Reform, is something that it's unprecedented, historic. No democracy in the world has ever tried to do what we are doing. We are creating a new social tool in governance. A number of us who make talks around the not only the province, indeed the world and this North America, make this assertion, and nobody has contested it. Nowhere have citizens, randomly selected, then self-selected, been given a role in a very important public policy question, which, if there is a recommendation for change, goes directly to the people of British Columbia. So this is historic, it's innovative, and it's a huge responsibility for all of us. And here we are, in the fourth and final phase of the assembly. We were selected. We then took time to learn. We took time to listen to the people of British Columbia. We took time in the summer, and I think we did a lot more reading than we thought we'd ever expect to do. And now we are here. It's decision time. And within 4 weeks, we will have made a decision as to whether or not the system we currently have will change, and if so, to what others. And this is the beginning. Another something else that's a record is the members. We had 161 members of our assembly in January 1, 2004. And today, we are all pleased to say that today we have 161 members. A few members are encountering a few problems. We have 155 of 161 members. John Chapman has a family matter he must deal with. Ian Fleming has just been given a huge promotion with Sony, and Sony has asked him to be somewhere else today. Doug Waller on school business. Sylvia Williams is on leave. Her husband is very unwell and wants to be with him. And similarly with Glenn McKinnon. His wife is very unwell, and he must stay with her. Carolyn Fader is not well. So those six members are not with us today. We have promised them that we will send them the videotapes of the plenary and, of course, all the materials that are sent to all members. And Gladys Brown, where are you? Please stand. Where's Gladys? There's Gladys. Look. Last Saturday in the BC Senior Games, Gladys won the silver medal for the 800 meters. And I am so pleased that she's so pleased. In the audience, we have several international visitors, members from the media, and many interested citizens. And many of these have been with us for every meeting of the assembly. And we welcome you all. I want to quickly report on some assembly business. In Prince George, we dealt with a matter as to whether this session ought to be open to the public or not. The Gibson Report, which we roughly follow, is Mr. Gibson here? Don't see him. They recommended that for the fall session, the Assembly ought to deliberately make a decision as to whether, when they get to decision time, that these sessions ought to be closed or open. And the Assembly members overwhelmingly confirmed that these sessions should be open to the public and to the media, and that all major decisions will be made in this plenary hall. Discussion groups will be closed as last year to the public, and the group that we used to have in the center will also be closed. So discussion groups will be closed, plenary will be open, and all decisions that are made that we have to make towards the mandate will be made in the plenary hall. And lastly, it is my pleasure to call upon Anna Rankin to give a report from the selection committee, that is the committee that selected the 9 presenters we are just about to hear from. Anna?
Thank you, Jack. Can everyone hear me? Okay. As a member of the selection committee, which chose and invited these 9 presenters from among the hundreds that we heard at our 50 public hearings, I've been looking forward to hearing these presentations for some time. The Assembly's selection committee was composed of 10 Assembly members chosen at random during a plenary session last spring. The chair was also a member of this selection committee. Our task was to select presentations that offered significant value to the entire Assembly as we begin the deliberation phase. And these are the presentations that you'll hear today. This committee's selections were based on criteria established by this Assembly in February, which are, 1, quality. The presentation delivered at a public hearing is clear and well thought out with coherent arguments. The proposal is fully detailed with effective application to BC circumstance. 2, our mandate. The thesis and argument of the proposal are consistent with the Assembly's mandate. 3, we gave consideration to the balance and representativeness of the presentation. The merit, if the proposal advances the Assembly's objectives by putting forward strong arguments worthy of consideration. Prior to our selection committee, our selection meeting, the committee received many thick packages from the Assembly office. We read the supporting documents available for each applicant, including their public hearing summaries and submissions. Then, after the last public hearing, the selection committee received a list of all the presenters who were recommended by the Assembly members, along with supporting reasons. Sorting through the 70-plus applicants and recommended presenters was a task made easier with the help of note-takers. Since they attended every one of the public hearings, Michelle, Hillary, and Catherine sat down with the staff and categorized the recommended presenters into themes and electoral systems. The selection committee met on July 10th in Vancouver and worked as a group to apply the Assembly's selection criteria. We carefully considered the names before us and in the end chose 9 presenters by consensus. It's our hope that these presentations will help clarify some of the options as the Assembly works towards its recommendation. Lastly, I want you to know that a few weeks ago, the selection committee made a decision about today's schedule. The first and last presenters were assigned time slots so that the flow of presentations conforms to the Assembly's mandate to first examine electoral system options and then compare these to our current system. We also felt that although there may be advantages to grouping presenters by topic, in the spirit of fairness and knowing what great results are achieved through random selection, we agreed that the remaining presenters would be assigned their presentation times through a random draw. I hope you enjoyed today's presentations. Thanks.
Thank you, Adam. And now to the presentations. We have 9 presentations selected from among the 400 presentations that were made at public hearings. The selections were made, as Anna indicated, on the quality of the presentation, including the quality of the interaction during the discussion period with members, consistency with the Assembly's mandate, and reasonable balance among prominent electoral systems. We did not seek perfect balance among presentations because that simply would not be possible. Rather, the purpose of the presentations is really to set out some of the central electoral values inherent in competing systems, and to do so using presentations that were reasonably clear both in delivery and in answers to questions. Now, in coming to our ultimate decisions, that is, the decisions we have to make 4 or 5 weeks from now, individual decisions and our collective decision, we will, of course, not count the number of submissions and presentations for any one particular system. Rather, we will learn and take from all proposals what value they hold for us. And they all have been very helpful. The Assembly was charged to learn, to listen, and then decide. on the basis of each member's own values and what each member has learned throughout the past 10 months. The presentations and submissions, then, are a very important part, but not in themselves a determining part of our decisions. Now, biographical notes for the 9 presenters have been given to members. You have them in your folders. And these notes are available for the public on the information desk in the foyer. Presumably, most of you now have them. Because of this, I will introduce presenters only by name. We will keep to our schedule, 15 minutes for each presentation, 10 minutes for questions. Some of the questions from members were given to the presenters in advance of today's session. About 5, 7, or 8 members took the opportunity to send questions in advance. These questions were then sent to the presenters, so they've had a couple of days or so to think about them. I will read a selection of these for all to hear. And some questions, the first one, will be given from the floor. So I'll take the first question from the floor, 2 from those in advance, and then perhaps another one from the floor. The more concise the answers, of course, the more questions we can pose. Now, it is not likely that we will get to all the proposed questions. And we invite presenters to respond in writing to those questions that they didn't get a chance to respond to. So there may be 3 or 4 questions per presenter that were sent into us, all good questions, that we just simply didn't get a chance to respond to. And we are asking, I've already talked to a couple of presenters, and they think it's a great idea, that they respond to us in writing to those questions that they did not have a chance to respond to, and we will circulate those questions and those responses to all members. Indeed, if you will, we would be very happy to have your written response to all the questions that were posed to you. And, of course, we will send them to all members, and, of course, we'll put the responses on our website for everybody to see. And now, then, on to our first presenter. Our first presenter today is Ian McKinnon.
First, I have to turn on my mic. Hello, my name is Ian McKinnon. I'm going to give a presentation today that's geared in some ways around electoral systems. My experience has been working in government over the last 20-odd years in various capacities. I've also managed a large survey research firm where we did the research for 16 national or federal elections in Canada and 3 international elections, all with different electoral systems in the overseas. The observations I want to make today are reflected in the title. I want you to, as you deliberate, I think it's extremely important you take into account political parties, how they function, how electoral laws interact with them, and then after elections, how the outcome of an election affects government, the formation of government, the conduct, the duration of the government. Very quickly, you see those themes reflected up there. Why is it important? It's important because the public at large not only looks at the electoral system and electoral competition and its outcome, but their expectations are very much geared around how parties function within an electoral system. Do they understand what they do? Is it transparent in our current jargon? In other words, are deals made in back rooms, behind the old smoky back rooms, or behind closed doors, and governments suddenly are created after an election because of that? Do party officials, how do you get to know who's on the ballot? Is it because party officials create lists or direct the candidates be appointed, the unelected, unresponsible group? Or is it something that the broad public, as they're voting, understands and feel they can control? Now, why does it all matter? It matters because it goes to the heart of legitimacy in a democratic system. One of the themes that you've heard, I'm looking over many of the presentations that have been posted on your website, is that voters are frustrated if they risk having a wasted vote, if they can't vote for the people that they want or the policies they want because their vote will be, quote, unquote, wasted. But they also want assurance that the entire system, not just the translation of votes into seats, but that the entire system is responsive and open. And that means that, and I believe it's important for you to look beyond the simple first order question of, all right, with these votes, how do we translate into seats, into the both the front and back end of the process. The front end is voters want to know who gets to select who runs. What control do they have over things and involvement in the nomination process? Is it open? Is it responsive? And on the back end, once the election's over, they want to know that a well-functioning government is likely to come out. But in particular, they want to know and understand clearly how the election results gets translated into, okay, who actually runs the government and for what duration? In other words, a system that's fair and responsive. What matters? Well, first, transparency clearly matters in these issues. Voters are angered, as I've said, over backroom deals, secret of inter-party bargaining. There's a very interesting example about the first MMP election in New Zealand. And this is not a criticism of MMP, but it tells you something about the public's response to elections. They had an MMP election. It went well, by all accounts. But it took a month subsequently to form a government. There was intense backroom bargaining that the public didn't see. They'd finished the election. They didn't know the outcome in terms of government. When a government was finally formed, the pivotal small party allied with a major party who had they had spent the entire election hammering. Now, is that the fault of MMP? Is it an intrinsic flaw in MMP? No, it happens with minority governments. But what happened was that a lot of the support for MMP was undermined because of the lack of transparency. At the front end, we've had a number of cases in Canada where people have been very upset over candidate nomination processes. You had a fascinating example in my paper. I wrote it while the election was still on. But we had one right here in BC where, in part because of voter anger over a nomination process where a sitting MP was overturned, that MP was elected as an independent. And a wonderful reflection of the importance and motivation that the public have over that front end of the process. Now, let's get to systems briefly. First past the post, our system tends to have roots before party-centered elections. Now, I want to make one of its strengths is that it's a focus on individual candidates. Even at many municipalities, especially smaller ones, we still have so-called nonpartisan elections. That is, there aren't slates, there aren't formal parties. That's the way what our system evolved from. In contrast, PR systems are party-centered. They assume the existence of parties. They're based on that premise. Now, our mixed systems try to reap the benefits of both approaches. What happens, though, and this is looking at the front end around nominations, in our system, whether its roots are in the mix, are in the first past the post or multi-list, when the party apparatus controls the nomination process, power flows to the officials. One of the most interesting periods in my life was working in an election in the purest PR system on earth, Israel's single district, 120 members. There, the power of life and death was not how well did your party do, but where you stood on the party list. So what did members of the Knesset or potential members of the Knesset spend all their time doing? Was it improving the position of the party, talking to the public? Uh-uh. If they wanted to succeed, what they had to do was do as well as they could, be as high as they could be on the list. They spent all their focus on the disputes, the factions, the fighting inside the party. The electorate hated it, but it was the rational thing to do. Now, what happened? Party professionals ran the show. An important consideration, I think, therefore, is the conclusion I have here, that it is important to have a structure and a set of rules so that there is more, that there is at least some autonomy over either local nomination processes or the equivalent of an open list system where people actually get to rank the candidates. Now let's move to the back end, forming governments. Well, simple fact here. Our first-past-the-post system tends to produce artificial majorities. You've all seen the data. It's very, very rare that any either provincial or federal government has won more than 50% of the vote and has a natural majority. When they do get 50% plus of the vote, they routinely get 80 or 90% of the seats, so it's an exaggerated majority. Our system of government, what happens after they're in power, has evolved so that it functions well. It assumes almost the existence of a majority government. In minority governments, there are two problems that arise. First, the public doesn't like repeated elections. We haven't found a way of doing what so-called REIT presidential systems, Italian, variety of other European systems do, find a way of changing governments without calling an election. We just can't do it very well. What am I going to say to you then there? Well, part of it is thinking of your recommendation should be thinking about how it meshes with our current system, or given your charge, and I know you're not allowed to, you're not supposed to recommend changes to the constitutional structure, but I think it's well within your ambit to recommend something to government, saying, look, a fairer electoral system may produce a lot more minority governments. We recommend these changes that maybe be beyond the formal scope. You can't authoritatively tell them you should do this, but it'll make a real difference. Second parts of minorities, lots of backroom dealing, sometimes formal deals, sometimes informal. The public dislikes it because it absolutely lacks that openness and transparency. And, as we know, frequent elections reduce turnout. Now, recommendations. First, as it's not only the translation of votes into seats that's really important. I think it's important for you to ensure that a well-functioning system has rules around how one becomes a candidate and you can and expectations of parties in doing it. As an interesting example, I'm not very fond of the American system in many ways, but that's precisely what a primary is. You know, all the Democrats in California get together to say, okay, who's the Democratic candidate going to be that we put up against the Republican or whatever else? Whatever you like or don't like about the rest of their system, that's almost the ultimate example of openness on the front end, of ensuring that there's control over who is nominated. So you set standards for nomination process. I also think that you can set rules or advise on rules to ensure a measure of constituency or local nomination independence. In a more proportional system, a very simple piece of advice, have open rather than closed party lists. Although, frankly, the history on open lists where there's a set list and you can go in and re-rank it is that almost nobody does that. There are systems that force you to rank it, which are the most open of all, and they really do ensure greater transparency. Finally, they have to ensure that setting the party list is not purely an internal party affair by setting standards and rules appropriate to that system. At the back end of your recommendations, consider how it meshes with our Westminster parliamentary government. You're charged to make recommendations that are effective given the current form of government, but I think it's important that you be willing to make those observations and recommendations about changes potentially in the Westminster system so that it doesn't become so problematic if there routinely are minority governments. If I were forced to pick, and I'm not standing here saying I've got the answer to it all, I'm a real believer in gradualism. and therefore, I tend to support what is called the proportional representation light proposal that you saw, which is to run with our current system, set aside 15-20% of seats as top-up to ensure that those voices, party voices that are not represented by single members being elected, have a voice in the legislature, it creates increased proportionality. It's not nearly as good as many of the other options for proportionality, but it gets much closer. It ensures voices are present. It ensures you don't get an outcome like 77-2 or, in New Brunswick's case, 100-0 various others, 100%, that is. It also gives us as a society and a polity a chance to evaluate the changes before we've finished. All right, I've tried to keep this as brief as possible. There's obviously a longer written thing that from the questions I see many of you have read that I've done, and I'll turn it back for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. McKinney. We'll take first a question from the floor. FW.
Mr. McKinnon,
yes.
We seem to be boxed in by the Westminster system. Mm-hmm. And one of our past people on the national stage was Preston Manning. And he said, just do away with the confidence convention. Wouldn't it just take a bit of goodwill to make this work? What's your opinion?
Okay. The confidence... Let me expand for a moment. Certain bills, second reading of a major bill, a financial bill, or something that is explicitly listed as a confidence vote, if governments lose on that in the House, they're deemed to have, they're forced to resign, in essence. Mr. Manning's notion is, in fact, very correct, that if we didn't, and you're seeing some current maneuvering with the NDP, the Conservatives, and the Bloc, saying, hey, we want to write the Governor General, say, we don't take confidence as seriously. Maybe we should have a second vote so we can vote down government legislation without precipitating an election. The dilemma that you face in that is that the government may, for example, bring forward a budget, say, this is absolutely critical to our vision of what is going to happen in this province. They lose a vote. To force a government to carry on when its core legislation has been brought down is very, very tricky. Loosening, I mean, at one time we had an argument whether a late night third vote over, I think it was an increase in postal rates, was going to bring down a government. Everybody kind of decided, wait a sec, this is silly. Yes, it was a financial bill, but it was third reading, you know, let's vote the next day as to whether that constituted confidence in the government. We changed our procedure. It is possible to loosen it up, but underlying the issue is a more important, or I think a much graver one, which is if governments lose on something that's core to them, pivotal, you know, our election, we promised to do X, they lose it in the House, they will want to resign. I think the real issue is how do you change from government A, say parties A, B, and C, to a new government that may be parties C, D, and E without precipitating, without having an election. That's the real change we need. And it means that you have to have somebody other than an appointed official like the Governor General who makes the call. That's the real killer in our system. Sorry to take so long on that one.
This question from John Zoll. Must we have a political system that encourages the central role of political parties in the democratic process?
This is a terrific one from political science theory. Whether you love parties or not, and I have a healthy skepticism about them, they are central. And they are central for organizational and administrative reasons. We have too big a country to have, or even a province, to try to do at large with just people out there. The second thing is parties serve to make things simpler to people. They bundle together a whole bunch of issues, and they say, here's where we stand on this type of tax, on another type of tax, this type of issue. And so people end up having kind of clear bundles to choose from. If you didn't have the parties, I think it would be impossibly difficult for people to vote knowing what policies as opposed to what persons they were voting for.
Thank you. We will take another question actually from the floor. Ken. We're going to try and make questions and answers as brief as we can and get as many as we can. I know you are. Thank you.
Sorry.
Ian, you referred to Brian Schwartz's proportional reputation late. If I remember, he specifically was talking about MMP late. Am I right? Or
it effectively is very much like MMP, where you have constituencies and then you top it up on the other side so you have something. But instead of doing 50-50, he was proposing a much lower number so that we weren't radically altering the system in terms of his probability. It's more likely to have minorities than our current system, but not almost certain to have minorities. And he's saying this moves us a fair bit of the way there. It lets everybody evaluate it. It allows us, if everyone's unhappy, to move back. But it also says, hey, this is working better. We're hearing voices we didn't hear before. You can then go forward. It's a transitional suggestion.
So are you in particular endorsing MMP late or just in general a late version of some sort of PR system?
I think a light, what I'm really saying is a light version. It's harder with some than others. Single transferable, for example, is much harder to envisage a light system. But I think you ought to put that in the backs of your mind as you do your deliberations over the next 2 weeks.
Thank you. Here's a question from Shoney Field. You made the point that in your written presentation that STV serves local interests very well. In your opinion, does it serve them too well, resulting in provincial politicians focusing more on local municipal issues while province-wide policy suffers?
That was clearly the conclusion of the British experts who looked at this in the last decade. The incentive, actually, and one of the easiest ways to look at all of this is to say, what's the incentive for individuals and parties? Frankly, having been inside parties, if rules change over things like nomination, leadership, or elections, the first thing they all do is sit down and go, how do these new rules, how can we work them to our advantage? Okay? As background, if you think about that system, what happens is people are saying, okay, I'm going to vote Fianna Fáil or whatever else, the party is the first choice. But what really matters to the individuals is, okay, who do they rank first in this county or district within that party? And so there's an enormous pressure on the members to become incredibly locally oriented. The argument in the British Commission was that, in fact, it became very difficult to bridge local parochial interest and look for the national interest in Ireland. I don't know from first-hand observation how true that is.
This is a question from David Wills. I'm interested in your statements that the Westminster system does not deal well with minority parliaments, that minority governments are unstable, and that the resulting frequent elections decrease turnout. Mm-hmm. However, I note that Germany and Ireland, which use different types of PR systems, have had no more frequent elections than we have had in Canada, despite their minority governments. Please comment.
I'd like to take those two separately. Germany is very interesting. Germany, I think there's a cultural issue here that between the First and Second World War, the Weimar Republic was a wide-open PR system. It was part, I wouldn't argue it was the cause, but it was part of the chaos of German politics in the 20s and early 30s and allowed, in part, Hitler's rise. Boom. Let's put that to the side. Germans have that as a cultural background. They brought in a 5% floor. And I think part of the political culture is we can't go that way again. We can't have these incredibly narrow, intense interests. And it's created pressure that has supported dominantly two parties with a third, initially the Liberal Democrats. Ireland, different case. Ireland, again, has very established divisions arising in part out of both the struggle for independence and the Civil War immediately following in the 1919-1921 period that tended to produce very hard lines between some of the parties, and that has kept them together. The other part is because neither is a Westminster parliamentary system, although Germany hasn't changed governments, it is possible to change the governing coalition. In the Irish system, is my understanding, that you can, if a party can't survive, they can form a different coalition or bring new partners in. That, my argument, is what is really essential, is finding a way to change a governing coalition in a minority situation without having elections. If you combine a system that produces almost all minority governments without solving that problem, you're going to have recurring minority governments. It drives Canadians crazy. We haven't had one for 25 years federally, but if you go back, 57, 62, 63, 65, 72, 79, we had, what's that, six, I guess, in the very short space of time, it drove Canadians nuts. You go back to the polling data out of that period, they were really upset with the political system.
I think one more question, Anne Rushlow.
Right. Yes, you recommended an open list being a better option than a closed list, but then you went on to say that the statistics don't support that people actually use the opportunity to rank candidates when given on a list. Could you comment on that further?
Two things. There are really three levels. One is a closed list. The party does the list, the Israeli system. As an example, you vote for the party, they get X number of people off the list. There's a wide open where there is no structuring of lists in order, although, anyway, there's a long footnote out of Australia on that, where lots of people go in and go from the top to the bottom, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the so-called donkey vote in Australia. So it really matters if you're alphabetically first or if your party puts you first on your list. In between are, here's the party list, if you just vote for the party, this is the order it comes, but you can change it around. The reality is that most people aren't as deeply involved in politics and process as junkies like me or as people who are as interested as you are. So for them, it's enough to check the party. Having the capacity to change is a little bit of a discipline. It's just like the capacity to vote for an independent in our system. Happens rarely, but it's sort of wonderful when it does, regardless of who gets elected. Lots of people cheered whether they liked Chuck Cadman or not, because, hey, it says that somebody can do it as an independent. That's a good thing. So that capacity is important in abstract. Frankly, it is very rarely utilized. Okay?
Ian?
All right.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank all of you.
Our next presenter is Bruce Halser. Bruce? Hi, Bruce.
Can I use your cup glass? Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Jack. And I'm pleased to have been invited before you to speak as an individual presenter. I'll have to say my presentation may not be as exciting as some others because it's the product of a committee, but I'll try my best. It's the product of a group of which I have the honor of serving as National Vice President, Fair Vote Canada, which has members across the country that are keenly watching this process. We think it has important national implications. We're watching it so closely that our president, Doris Anderson, has come all the way from Toronto to be one of the observers, as well as many other members. Our statement of purpose identifies four important objectives in a voting system: broad proportionality, extended voter choice, stable and responsive government, and maintaining a link between representatives and geographic constituencies. My presentation is going to be about explaining what these principles mean and applying it to some of the systems that you have before you. First of all, broad proportionality. I think it's pretty obvious. It simply means that partisan representation in a legislature should broadly reflect the total number of votes that each party receives in an election. We should get as close as we can to making every citizen's vote count. And perfect proportionality may not be possible or even desirable, but whatever system is chosen, It should correct the egregious problems in our present system, which means the party that gets the most votes should generally get the greatest number of seats. Parties with respectable overall support but less concentrated geographic support should not be penalized. And in summary, the relationship between the portion of votes and the portion of seats should be much stronger than it is today. The second principle, extended voter choice, is very limited by our single member system because people only have one choice and they have to combine a whole bunch of factors into expressing themselves. Research shows that although we vote for individuals, the vast majority of people actually vote for their party of choice regardless of who their local candidate is. Many voters, however, can't even vote for their party preference because they know their vote will be wasted, and instead many choose to cast strategic votes, meaning they actually have to vote for somebody they don't actually support, because in this system that has more utility than just going and honestly casting your ballot. And even those voters who have the luxury of selecting their party of first preference are sometimes required to vote for a candidate they don't particularly like as the only means of supporting their party. I believe that voters could be offered a choice of representatives within a political party, and that can be accomplished using open lists on one system or with an STV type of system. The third principle is stable and responsive government. In British Columbia, we have seen government policy lurch from one side to the other, with successive governments running roughshod over the opposition and then seeing some of their most important work simply undone by the next government. We've seen this on more than one, certainly more than two or three occasions. And this happens because under single-member plurality, votes are never accurately translated into seats won. In 1991 and 1996, the NDP formed majority governments, even though they got less votes than they received in 1983 and 1986, where they lost decisively. Modest shifts in voter support, even 5 or 10% shift, can produce dramatic changes in the seats held by different parties. Under any broadly proportional system, the composition of the legislature would be more stable, leading in the long run to more stable policy. Coalitions, which as you've heard are more characteristic of PR elections, I believe force governments to be more responsive to the wishes of voters in between elections. Under single member plurality, governments, and we see it all the time, with 40% of the vote or less, can really do what they please between elections. The final principle is regional representation. Historically, when our system was established, I think it's true that most voters' primary identification was with their local community or neighborhood. I don't think that's any longer true for a lot of people. Especially in urban centers, a lot of people don't even know who lives next door to them, let alone all the people in their block. They have little connection with their surrounding neighborhood, except that's where they go to eat and sleep. They identify often primarily with cultural communities, religious communities, workplace communities, and other social groups that are not defined by traditional geographic boundaries. That is not, people don't see themselves as somebody who lives in Marpole or Oak Bay as much as they see themselves as belonging to some other group. Nevertheless, there are British Columbians, both in rural and urban areas, who do continue to value the idea of having somebody who's responsible to them, somebody who will pay particular attention to their needs if they phone up the government. And it's important to maintain this tradition, as well as to provide broader representation to non-geographic communities of interest. I believe a well-designed system can achieve one without compromising the other. Looking at implementation, I'd be the first to agree that there's a certain tension between some of these objectives, but I don't agree that they're incompatible. The challenge of this assembly is to not to pick one over the other, but to find a system that can balance all of them in a way that's appropriate for British Columbia. I'm just going to run through the five broad systems that are before you and talk about how I think these principles apply. The first is what we're all familiar with, single-member plurality, or first-past-the-post. And its problems have been well-documented, and I'm sure you're aware of them. Using first-past-the-post in the 21st century is kind of like using a hand-crank telephone instead of the Internet. It was fine in its day, but that century is long gone. It ignores the voices of a huge portion of voters by simply wasting their votes. It provides no proportionality, and not only does it blatantly exaggerate the support of parties who have geographically concentrated support, but it often fails to give popular parties more seats than less popular parties. In the last 10 years, 3 provinces in this country have been governed by parties that got less votes than their opposition. How can that system be justified in a modern era? And in addition to creating an artificial disparity between parties and regions, single-member plurality systems are also well known for failing to provide adequate representation for women, minorities, and other underrepresented groups. The system simply fails to provide a real choice to a majority of voters, except unless you live in a handful of ridings that happen to be swing seats. Most voters know it makes no difference if they go to vote on election day or not. At most, their vote is a symbolic act, a duty of citizenship, which gives your party the bragging rights to one more fraction of a percent, but has no effect on the legislature. And most voters today know this. Young voters know this, and they're staying away from the polling places in droves. If you add to this the restricted choice that is offered to people who do show up and vote, you create a situation where voters feel divided loyalties among policies and candidates, and they're constrained in their expression. And finally, I would argue that this system fails to deliver stable and responsive government for the reasons I outlined earlier. There's no incentive for parties to cooperate, build consensus, or do any of the things that people from the left and right and center do on municipal council and in other forms of government, where artificial majorities do not hold sway over the public agenda. These ridings do, on their face, maintain a link between representatives and geographic communities, but because of these artificial majorities and party discipline, the real ability of local representatives to represent their communities is very limited, and we've all heard about that. I would strongly recommend that you make a clear and unequivocal statement that this dysfunctional 12th century voting system has no place in 21st century British Columbia. Some wish to cure this system with preferential ballot or runoff elections. You know about those. You either have a second election a couple weeks later just between the top 2 candidates, or people go in and mark their ballot in order of preference. This does solve the problem of limited voter choice to some extent, because people can give an honest vote when they go to vote. But it does away, it makes it even harder for smaller parties to get elected. Because by making this majority requirement in any riding to get elected, I think the result is, and you see this if you look at the 52 and 53 results in British Columbia, that you actually get less proportionality than you have now, if that's possible. Using this system just creates a new way of having the same old problems. Purely proportional representation, I don't think that's seriously before this group, so I'm not going to go into it in any detail. It may work in some countries, but in British Columbia, we can do better. And then we get down to the next two, MMP and STV, which I think are the systems you have to be looking at very seriously. MMP addresses the local representation problem by allowing for some constituency MLAs. And I think it's important, doing this, to look at the proposals you've had before you and not to adopt the system like they have in Russia, where the list is a parallel list, where the MLAs elected on the list are strictly proportional to the popular vote. What other people are advocating here, and I think is much better, is a compensatory list where you top up in order to get more proportionality. The concern about MMP is riding size. The more proportional you want the legislature, the larger you will have to make individual ridings. And the trade-off between losing a degree of local representation versus the benefits of proportionality are the things you're going to have to deliberate on. Single transferable vote, another option that can solve the problem of accommodating rural and remote areas, but it may not guarantee the same degree of proportionality as MMP. While MMP is designed to be roughly proportional, STV simply produces it as a byproduct, and it's not designed for proportionality. It does, however, do a better job, I think, of providing extended voter choice, because it's the voters and not the parties who make the final selection of candidates. Not only can STV voters rank their members in whatever order they choose, but they can vote across party lines based on individual characteristics, and they can vote for independent candidates, which are an important, I think, an important safety valve in our system. In Ireland, for example, roughly 10% of the members elected in the last election under STV were independents. In STV, you also have the benefit of knowing that all members, not just some, represent geographic constituencies. The constituencies are larger because you have to have multiple member ridings to make it work, but you will have the same number of members per riding that you have now, and you have presumably people in Greater Victoria or the Okanagan having more than one member to go to, and if they happen to be supporters of one party or another, they're more likely to be able to go to a member who represents their area and also represents their philosophical interest and preference. The main criticism of STV is that it produces a higher real threshold than most MMP systems, with a threshold of about 14% in six-member districts. In Ireland, small parties routinely win seats in four-member districts with as little as 10 to 12% of first preference votes, which can mean that a party that gets maybe 6 or 7% across the province has a pretty good shot at electing in the ridings that it does well in. Now, none of these systems is without fault, but some of them are capable of addressing all the values I talked about, and others reflect only one or two of the four values. These are the choices that you're going to be required to make over the coming weeks as you conclude your deliberations. It will be difficult, and some of you, like many electoral reform advocates, will strongly disagree over the answers. But please don't let the lack of a perfect system prevent you from making a recommendation for change. No system may be perfect, but the one we have today is about as far from ideal as you can get. The reason that this assembly exists is because we have a crisis in our democracy that needs to be fixed. Falling voter turnout, adversarial and negative politics, public cynicism, these are the results of first past the post. All of you have by now dedicated thousands of hours to the pursuit of something better. Please use your time to make a decision and put something forward that British Columbians will be able to consider and vote on in the referendum next May. Whatever option you put forward, British Columbians will thank you for giving them the choice and for the tremendous personal sacrifice of time and energy that you have devoted to this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. First, a question from the floor. Rob, have you got one? Because I didn't get to you last time.
Yes, just a quick question for you. With regards to just reading your proposal here, one of the key concerns is that you're getting to make it so that the public has an ability to vote who they want to vote for, as opposed to the strategic voting of today. Under the STV system that you're recommending to some degree, do they actually get to vote for who they want to, though, or are they, because you're ranking your vote, you end up voting for who you don't want to sometimes if your original party doesn't get enough votes? Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I think in either STV or mixed member proportional, you can devise a system that gives people more choice. In MMP, if you have open lists, then people can often have more choice. So when I say you should give voters choice, I'm not recommending one particular system. I'm saying whatever system you look at, I think that's a value you need to incorporate into it. And I think, obviously, there will always be a temptation by some voters to do what we always are extolled to do by different parties in elections, and that is to make sure we throw the bums out or make sure you don't elect these guys, and by doing that, you got to vote for me and not for this guy you really like. That argument is very powerful in our present system. It becomes less and less powerful the more choices voters have. Can you entirely eliminate it? Perhaps not, and certainly if you have a 5% cutoff, even on a pure PR system. If you have a 5% cutoff and I like a party that's probably polling 3%, I'll be susceptible to that argument. But the more choice you give voters, the less sway that argument has, and I think that's a value that you should be looking at.
This is a question from Wendy Bergerud. Would you agree that MMP mixes two of the worst systems together? Constituency seats selected by plurality votes and closed list PR, where the party leadership chooses who is at the top of their list. Would you agree that this is a fix, in quotes, of the FTP system instead of an overhaul of our electoral system?
Yeah, I wouldn't agree that it's combining the worst of two elements. I'd say that actually it combines the better part of two elements. And I suppose a judgment of better or worse is a value that each of you are going to have to make. But the question implies that MMP must have closed lists. And that's certainly one approach, and there are good arguments for that approach. But if that MMP can also have open lists, as I've discussed, so that voters can express their preference for individual candidates within a list. And so I think MMP, like STV, can attempt to embrace that balance of values that British Columbians demand. And I think that by introducing proportionality but keeping geographic representation, it attempts to strike the kind of balance that I'm talking about.
Here's a question from Anna Rankin. Which system, STV or MMP, would result in more women getting elected in office? 5 seconds, please.
In 5 seconds, I tell you, I don't know. I think you're going to hear presentations from advocates for both sides of that question today. I don't honestly know. I think it partly depends on the design of the system. And I think one of the most important factors in getting underrepresented groups into the legislature is the nomination process rather than candidates on a list. We actually elect women in British Columbia roughly proportional to how many candidates we have for major parties. The issue is, how do women get to be candidates? It's something you should consider. I wouldn't say that one is better than the other of those two systems. It gets the devil's in the details.
Tanis.
At the end of your presentation, you said that if we elect change, you think that British Columbians will thank us for our time and energy. What do you think British Columbians will respond to if we don't recommend change?
I think that British Columbians are... I think the reason why this assembly exists is because there is an appetite for change. There's certainly an appetite for change among people who've looked at electoral systems, among a lot of people who've participated in elections, and I think there's a general public dissatisfaction with the system. They tell public pollsters they don't like the system, and they tell us on election day they don't like the system when they don't bother to vote. I think you have an opportunity here to give British Columbians a choice. I think the debate that you have all had over the last several months and are going to have over the next month has probably been enlightening for you, and I think that British Columbians deserve to participate in that debate. So I would definitely urge you to give them an option. I think British Columbians will be very disappointed to know that you've all assembled and looked at this and you think we can't do any better. The voting system we have arrived by a historical accident. There was no debates in the legislature to adopt this. It was simply the voting system we used in Britain and in the New Dominion of Canada, and we adopted it. This is the first time British Columbians have ever had a chance to have an input on this, and I'd hate to see that they had that opportunity denied. And I'm confident that you will see the wisdom in that.
This is a question from Anna Rankin. What do you say to critics who claim proportional systems such as MMP and STV will create coalition governments that are inherently unstable?
Well, you know, I disagree with the concept that the Westminster model cannot allow governments to change without elections. Those of you who are students of Canadian history will know in the King Byng affair, that actually happened. It became an election issue, but constitutionally, the Governor General was quite right to allow a government to change without an election. And I think in a different system, we could accommodate that and develop traditions for that. That would not be a problem. But before we even get to that, I would argue that international experience shows that MMP and STV systems produce stable, effective, and responsible governments the same as we have had here. As has been pointed out, Germany has had pretty stable government since 1949. Post-war Germany has had 14 elections since 1949, 11 after 4 years, 3 after 3 years. That's pretty similar to the record in British Columbia. Ireland has had 14 elections since 1948, most every 3 or 4 years, with only 3 times having shorter terms. New Zealand, since it changed to its current system, all 3 parliaments have run their full term, and they have a Westminster model. Let's not forget, as well, that coalitions are not foreign to our system. We had a coalition government in British Columbia for the better part of 40 years called Social Credit. To a great extent, we have a coalition government now called the BC Liberals, and to another extent, the New Democratic Party government represented a coalition of interests. These coalitions were formed behind closed doors, before election, in party conventions and back rooms. In minority governments, coalitions are formed in the full public view, and we watch the excruciating negotiations happen.